The Spiritual Warrior, Talk 35, by Asha Praver, September 20th, 2011, copyright 2011, Ananda Church of Self-Realization, Palo Alto.
Do we have any questions or? Okay, Liz, you have to find a direction to go. Move when your chair's too. Yeah, in between. Do we have any questions or thoughts from last week? Yes, Diane?
I mean, these chairs, I mean, sometimes I feel really good, like when I'm meditating, but I lean back against the chair. I mean, is it important to hold your back up on your own, or is it okay to rest against the chair?
I often rest against the chair because the chair just doesn't fit me otherwise, and I have to sit comfortably back against it. When I meditate in this chair for a long period of time, I usually put something else there so that I can sit up straighter. It's just, you know, we had a long tush test and tested a whole bunch of chairs, but you know, everybody's body's different.
I just wondered if it's not crucial to hold your back up on your own.
It's better when you meditate to not be leaning because you don't want to be collapsed. But you have to be realistic. The most important thing is to meditate.
It's important to keep it straight.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, okay. Thanks. Any other questions? Comments? Okay. Where we got up to last week was right to the point of read the renunciant's valiant vow, it said. Take one line at a time and meditate on it and think out in detail what is involved in it. Try to put it into practice daily. The renunciate's valiant vow was published in the 1936 edition of Whispers from Eternity, and it didn't appear in later editions. Ewan Master was alive. He had both the renunciate's vow and the wedding vow in that early edition. I don't think by the time the one that Swami edited it was still in there anymore. For the brahmacharis, which was the young monks, and brahmacharinis, the young nuns, before they would take the final vow of sannyas, this was the vow that they took. So this is how Master initiated them, and that's why he was suggesting here that you think about it. And they didn't have any separate vows of discipleship, except Master just making them disciples. So this was really, for the life of the hermitage, this was really the vow for both the men and the women. And for a lot of years at Ananda, when we were all living as renunciates, this was also our vow. And we always enjoyed the fact that Master called it what he called it, the renunciant's valiant vow. He never hesitated to be colorful when he could be, you know, or to be expressive. I've been doing a class over the internet. Do you need copies of it? Any of you guys? I have a few extra here. Whoever needs them. We're going to go to it in just a minute. I'm doing another class on Whispers from Eternity. That's a webinar that I'm doing over the internet. And one of the things that I tuned into in Master's explanation of Whispers, which I had actually not always noticed before, you know, there's just so many different phrases in all of their writings that you can just read and not really hear a phrase. But one of the things he said about the Whispers was that he had the experience first, and then he tried to put words on it. You know, for many of us, we try to find words, you know, and write something that seems to express, I suppose, what it is, what we're feeling. But for him, he just caught it. He caught what the feeling was, and then he would bring it down to the level of verbalization. And then in asking us to use his poems and his prayers, that's why he called them answered prayers, because the answer to the prayer came first, and then he would put words onto whatever it was that he'd received from God. And he would tell us, when we read or work with those whispers, to try to find behind the words whatever the consciousness was that happened to him. And that's where the power goes through it. That's why he said, after I'm gone, read my whispers. Through it I will speak to you. So this is, and I was thinking about that just, I see that Liz is carrying Purushottama Joseph Selby and Vyasa's book about the yugas, and just to encourage everyone to read that book, as I have been doing every time I get a chance. One of the things that they talk about in that book is when they start talking about ascending yugas and then descending yugas, and he's trying to tell us, and Sri Yukteswar says this in The Holy Science, he says, you cannot imagine what consciousness, even on a material plane, can be like in the higher yugas. So Sri Yukteswar makes no attempt to even explain it. And Purushottama tries to tell us in his book also that I know this is going to be hard for people to understand, but what is spoken of by the masters is that we reach the point in the Treta Yuga and in Satya Yuga of complete telepathic communication, where we just understand each other vibrationally with thought, and that speech is, verbal speech is not essential, and written speech is completely unnecessary, because everything can be done by thought transference, even at a distance. And then when the yugas begin to decline, there's a point at which we lose that, and then we have to start having language and then written language. And he proposes very interestingly that the Sanskrit language was created as the yugas began to descend and language was needed. And it was created perfectly. You know, it's considered to be one of the most perfect languages because it came out of the time just when language was required again, because intuition and mental telepathy was no longer possible. But I think of that in terms of Master communicating through his whispers, with which this Valiant Vow is an example, of being compelled to try to put into words something that what he really wants to communicate to us is merely telepathically, vibrationally, just a direct transference of consciousness. And so sometimes, in fact, one of the reasons Swami edited that Whispers book is because Master, in the desire to put the experience across, was just so exuberant in his language that sometimes it was hard even to understand, because the words were just, the words and the images and the ideas just poured out, and Swami just smoothed it out enough so that you can feel it more easily with the level of mind that we work with. But so also whenever we read something, including this, which we'll now go over as he suggests, line by line, the feeling of it is as important as the words of it, and much of it is just conveyed by what it feels like. So first let's read the whole thing. I'll read the whole thing out loud, and then we'll just have fun with it. The Renunciant's Valiant Vow. My body, mind, and soul come from God, and to Him I dedicate them. Let my love become His love. Let my life become His life. Let my desires become His desires. Let my soul become His spirit. Let my eyes behold as He beholds. Let my ears listen to His truths alone. Let my mind become His mind. Let my intellectuality become His wisdom. Let my love seek nothing but His love. He is my only beloved, who will always love me. Let my aspiration be to carry out His will gladly. I will reason, I will, I will act, but guide Thou my reason, will, and activity to the right path in every action. Be Yours the only love reigning in the bower of my heart. To please You, I will act, but not for my own desires. In carrying out Your wishes, I will be ambitious. To receive You, I renounce all else. I will never marry, for You are my only beloved. My flesh, my mind, my love, my life, my soul belong to You, O Spirit, and no animality shall desecrate what belongs to You. You are my lover. I am Your beloved. You are my father and my mother. I am Your child. You are my master. I am Your servant. You are my friend. I am Your friend. You are my guru preceptor. I am Your disciple. My hands will work for you only. My feet will march unceasingly toward your kingdom. My brain will work your problems alone. My heart will love you alone. My soul will become your spirit. Finding your perfect love, I shall seek no other love. Finding you, I have found everything. I will not work to please myself or anyone else except my God and Guru. Finding perfect love in meditation, I shall never seek perishable human love. Finding God's complete love, I shall seek no other love. All things which are mine belong to you. Therefore, I give myself and all I possess to you alone. It's a big vow. I was reading this afternoon, God is for Everyone. And in it, Swamiji chronicles Master's thoughts, because he rewrote that book from something Master wrote. Master's thoughts of what it is that we're all seeking. And he just describes this natural attitude that the human being has, that whatever is bigger than we are already looks threatening to us. And he talks about how ironic it is that we have this resistance to going forward for what is actually going to give us more of everything we want, but because it requires a shift from what we already know, that the natural human tendency is to cling. And it's really just exactly true. And Master uses the image all the time of the bird that has always lived in the cage. When the door of the cage is open, the first thought that crosses the bird's mind is not, oh, I can go out and be free. It's to back up from the door and to be quite intimidated by what it sees in front of us. And the only reassurance we have on this, besides our own experience, of course, is the word of the Masters. And so there's always this extraordinary interplay between our own experience, between our faith in what the gurus tell us, and then the courage that gives us to take a step in a direction that really looks like the unknown to us. In our Festival of Light every week, we have that little cycle with the bird, where the bird first just clings to everything for himself, and then he gets caught in the storms, and he's persuaded to sort of go with the flow, and he goes with the flow, and he finds out that works pretty well. And he feels that now things are a little better when I don't resist so much but cooperate. But then after a time, night falls. And then the bird becomes very insecure because he can no longer see where he's going. And he asks the simple question, how can I fly in this darkness? And that's often sort of where we find ourselves, which is everybody says it's nicer over there, but I don't know because I can't see. And I don't have that experience. And we can't advance spiritually unless we have what Yogananda called a little bit of spiritual adventurousness. And at the same time, so much of us just wants to sit right where we are. So, you know, Master gives us something like this, which is just basically telling you that everything that you really think of as your own just needs to be turned around and understood to be that you're only acting on behalf of the divine. And you know, I will never marry, I will never seek human love, everything belongs to you, I find all my satisfaction in my relationship with God. And, you know, even as I read it, you know, you can feel there's a certain subconscious resistance to it. You want to just always say, almost, except for a little bit. And that's why he calls it valiant, because there's a lot of courage required. And part of, I think, what we're going to just do right now is just sort of to feel, you know, where these thoughts come from and how we can attune ourselves with them more. Does anyone have any comments or thoughts about this from hearing or reading this over the week before? There it is.
Yeah. I think for me, just exactly what you were saying, that sense of the resistance that's just under the surface where you say, oh, no, not that far, or no, not that much, mm-hmm. or maybe just a little ways, or maybe just as far as I can see. Mm-hmm. Please not now, maybe later. It's really very, very complete. It covers everything.
It does indeed, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We used to joke in the monastery about that you sort of get lured out with naive enthusiasm, and you swim out from the shore, and you know you just think it's just fine, and then about halfway out or just too far from shore to turn back easily, it begins to dawn on you what you've really gotten yourself into. And you're, as we said, we're too far from shore to slim back easily. We're not close enough to the other shore to make it feel like it's just going to be an easy ride. So we start treading water and just start thinking about it, which doesn't really help anything. But you're just there sort of wondering what you're going to do next. And it's almost like the divine itself actually sort of blinds you to the implications of what you're doing. Or I wouldn't say it. That would be really an unfair way to put it. I think more accurately is we simply can't comprehend, because our own consciousness doesn't go that far, so we understand it in a certain way. And we get deeper into it, and we understand it in a deeper way. I don't really feel, even though we used to joke a lot about, you know, swimming out and not really knowing which way was the easiest way to go. It was a joke, but it was a joke to sort of keep our spirits up, because, you know, there's just a lot of... In God is for Everyone, Swamiji also has a paragraph that I'd remembered from reading this before, and I can't quote it exactly, but he's talking about habits, and he's talking about how the roots of habits reach down into the deepest caverns of your subconscious, and then they twist around, and it's very complicated. And so you make a resolution to go in a certain direction, but all that you have to excavate out of yourself. And the odd thing about it is, this has at least been my own experience, our initial concept of what it is that we need to do to make ourselves into more spiritual people is usually completely wrong. Usually our self-understanding at the beginning of the spiritual path tends to be to exacerbate our faults rather than to surrender our egos completely. Thinking of various friends of mine who've had issues. You know, people who are very perfectionist think that the way they're really going to progress on the spiritual path is just to do everything better and better and better, not understanding that very preoccupation with perfection keeps your mind orbiting around yourself, and that a release of that kind of perfectionism to go more with the flow is actually more what the Divine Mother wants. I remember for myself, I didn't understand this particular line, let my intellectuality become his wisdom. And because I had always moved through life a great deal by my mental understanding, when I had issues on the spiritual path, I just thought if I had deeper mental understanding, then I would be stronger on the path. And it took me many, many years before I understood that the entire direction that I was going was just never going to take me to where I was trying to go, that a completely other quality of consciousness was needed, which was not about becoming less intelligent. It was just about not using my mind in that particular way, nor is a less self-preoccupation with one's own performance, so to speak, is not necessarily, therefore, to do a less conscientious job. It's just to redefine what conscientious is. And the way Master defines everything in this vow is to move the center of your energy from the medulla to the Christ center. Because that's really what he's saying. Because all the same qualities of life have to come forth. Even he says, I will reason, I will, I will act. But we're asking God to guide our reason and our actions and our will so that we act not from habitual, ego-motivated perception of reality and instead just recreate our entire sense of who we are and what we're doing. Chittambar told me that in the Raja Yoga 2 class last Wednesday, Nirmoha stood up to lead the energization exercises, and he introduced this innovation. Normally, we think of ourselves as the body running energy through us. He suggested you think of yourself as the energy animating the body and just simply completely re-identify with a different aspect of it, which is just a fascinating way to think of it. And Chidambar was saying to me this morning, just completely changed everything. I am the flow of energy. So what we tend to think of ourselves is as is little individualized entities, and we try to attune ourselves and then be really super red-hot, focused little individual entities, even entities that are doing something that's God-uplifting, but we don't understand that what's really asked of us is not to be self-conscious at all. Just the spiritual path is really self-forgetfulness. That's where the dedication to service really helps us so much, because when the mind is on, how can I give? Who can I help? How can I love? What can I serve? We become much more deeply identified with what's flowing through us than when we're always asking, how do I feel? What do I want? Is this going to help me? Is this not going to help me? It's just a very different way of being in the world. Swami Kriyananda, you know, is always trying to get us to say that, to see that. And I've done so much, but I don't think about any of it. I don't identify with any of it. I don't think of anything that I've done as my own. And on one hand, you can sort of hear that is an affirmation of humility. But so often with him, what I've learned is he's not affirming any state of consciousness. He's actually describing the view. He's just describing the view from where he stands. And from where he stands, he watched the energy come through him. You know, he was present enough to see the energy come through. He was using his willpower to bring the energy through, but he was just watching it come through. He wasn't himself putting his own stamp on it. It was just to be there and use his will and then watch the energy come through. That's the state of the true renunciate, because the only thing you're really renouncing is your ego identification with what flows through you. Because the example of monasticism, of renunciation, which is really more accurate, that all of us have to follow, is the example of renunciation that was set for us by Master and Swami, which it's really hard to imagine two individuals less involved in the world. I mean, more involved in the world. You know, less really dropped out from the world than they are. They're dropped out of certain superficial aspects of it, but their ambition and commitment far exceeds, you know, anyone that you could imagine just working for himself. I mean, nobody working for himself would have the kind of capacity to put aside self-interest, you know, and therefore create. When Swamiji published the Material Success Course, the 26 Lessons on Material Success, we were trying to work on some advertising for that course, and I offered this as a suggestion for a way to describe it, because the Material Success Course, those 26 lessons, are Swami's description of how he went from being 36 years old, absolutely, literally penniless, without a friend in the world, and how, from nothing except his discipleship to Master, he created a worldwide spiritual organization in everything that he did. That it really is an autobiography of how he did it. And he really tells it like that, and it's very, very interesting. And I propose that if he had in fact worked for his self-interest, he would be a very famous millionaire, bazillionaire, because if all that energy had been directed toward self-aggrandizement in anywhere, even a fraction of that, you know, it would have been a super colossal rags-to-riches story. The reason that it isn't is because all the energy and all the money just ran through his hands and never stayed for any egoically based purpose. And he's as penniless today as he was 36 years ago. He has a lot more friends. But he doesn't have any more wealth than he ever did, because everything that was generated has gone through. But that's what we're talking about here. But then you look at a life such as the life that he's lived. You know, he lives comfortably. He has homes in three countries. He has, of course, thousands of friends. You know, he has the satisfaction of a life well lived. And that's what we have to look at as the promise. Oh, that's what happens when you live like this. And nobody can persuade you of it. You have to really pay attention and feel the courage in your own self. And if you don't, you have to work within the sphere of where you are, because it's not something that can be faked. You know, it can be affirmed. You know, you can step beyond, slightly beyond your comfort zone. I often come back to the subject of tithing, a full 10% of everything you earn, because it is an extremely accessible way to push the boundaries of your faith. It's an extremely grounded way to make a declaration about where your security comes from, where your wealth comes from, where your abilities come from, where your will, reason, and actions come from. It's just one way of saying, when we can't really absorb everything, that's at least one concrete way of saying, let me see how far I can stretch in this direction. And that's why I bring back, every time I can think of it, I bring it up. Because people are always asking me, how can I increase my faith? How can I increase my devotion? How can I feel closer to God? How can I serve? And I say, tithe 10% of your income. And they say, how can I increase my devotion? How can I serve? You know, it's just like it goes right by, because it's real. It's one of those things. I don't feel any compunction as a clergy person to talk to people about money, because I think money's an enormous part of our lives. I was astonished in Masters, that little book, Wisdom of Yogananda, How to Be Happy All the Time. Tremendous amount of that book is about money. I think it's because money is the source of unhappiness for so many people. He talks just a great deal about money and the lack of it, or the excess of it, or the accessibility of it, or the acquiring of it, or the spending of it, because it's the most concrete measurement of what we really believe. You know, what we do with our money and how we relate to it. It's very interesting. I don't think he actually says here about anything specifically about money, but let's find out. Okay. So, comments or thoughts about any of that? My body, mind, and soul come from God, and to Him I dedicate them. Well, Master just starts right in right at the beginning. I mean, body, mind, and soul, he says, this is where the line-by-line study, they come from God. And many people in the world don't believe in God, don't really know how to answer that question, but if you really stop and ask yourself, how did I ever get here in the first place? You know, and who am I? I'm looking at all your faces. You know, you're primarily only looking at me, but every one of you is different. Every one of you has this long and complex karmic history that just brought us right to this point. I mean, it's impossible not to really wonder. I mean, either you have to decide there's no system here at all, or there has to be some system so far beyond anything that we're thinking of. And he just sweeps it all in, body, mind, and soul. Just the spiritual part of myself, the mental part of myself, the physical part of myself, I am a manifestation of the Spirit. And the fact that we are manifested by the Spirit is a very fundamental part of what makes the spiritual path what it is. You know, we have not fallen. We are not separated. We are not forgiven. You know, we are not saved. We are a manifestation of the Spirit. It's a very, he doesn't use the word manifested here, but it's a very interesting word to contemplate. When you're manifested from something, you're just made from that. And you never are separated. It just takes another form. You know, you get a big bolt of fabric and you turn it into clothes. It was the bolt of fabric. It became something else, but it never stopped. It never became anything other. It just took a new form. So the very first line of this is, well, everything about me was manifested from God, so where else would I turn except to dedicate myself to the source of who I am? What's the source of my being? So that's where it all begins. I came from and I return to. That's all. The other aspect of that is that you have to realize body, mind, and soul came from God. And the ego wants to separate us in some way, wants us to feel bad, wants us to feel separated, wants us to feel unworthy, wants us to feel puzzled, all of these different things. But we came from God, and to him I dedicate them, the whole thing. And then we have these aspirations here. Let my love become his love, my life his life, my desires his desires. What we're saying here, among other things, is all of the natural impulses that come out of me, and one of the most natural impulses in our life is to love. It's the first thing that we do when we're little tiny babies. You know, that's why mothers and fathers like having babies, because the babies are so loving. And that's one of the really happiness-producing things about little children, is just how freely and totally they give their hearts. One of my friends who teaches kindergarten says one of the things she loves about teaching kindergarten is the children will always say, "You are my favorite teacher." Of course, they've never had any other teacher. She says, but it's very gratifying to be every child's favorite teacher. It's a small thought, but that's just how children are. Just completely enthusiastic because they live in the moment. So the love that I have, it's what Master's also saying here, and he begins with love, with the life itself, with all the desires we have. It's not that God is asking us to be, not that Master's asking us to be any less of those things. He's just saying, let the small ego self become an expression of the infinite. And so even the things I desire, let the only things that I desire be God-inspired desires. And let the love I offer to people be divine love, because the love that we offer so often is really for our own pleasure. You know, we want somebody to love so they'll love us back. We want somebody to love so that they'll help us do the things we want to do. They'll keep us company. You know, they'll provide companionship or sexuality or whatever it might be. So often the love we offer is really not divine love. Of course, we have to aspire from where we are. But, you know, the first prayer is, you know, Lord, let me love with your love. And it's so sweet and so rewarding. Let my life become his life. Everything about us, our life force, the ambitions and so on, as he says. Let my desires become his desires. So we have love, life, desires. Our soul become his spirit. So our spiritual self becomes united with the infinite. Then he says, let my eyes behold as he beholds. That's a very interesting one, isn't it? Because isn't it on Sunday we talked about Krishna says to Arjuna, you who are free of the carping spirit, to you I reveal these holy truths. And it's a question of what our eyes perceive. Because we're going to perceive. We're going to look around this world all the time. But to see the world as God sees it is so different than the way the ego wants to parse it apart. First of all, God has unconditional love for everyone. God has compassion for everyone. Now bear in mind, God is not always nice to everyone. Because the way God also perceives is that, as Swamiji phrased it, he sees egos struggling to be free. And sometimes egos struggling to be free have to be allowed to go through whatever they have to go through in order to achieve that. So part of being able to see the world as God beholds it is to be very calm and filled with faith no matter what's going on around us. Because the divine always stands in sort of loving understanding. You know, the divine picture holds everything. When Swamiji was being terribly, I was going to use the word abused, that's a word that people use, but he was being vilified and attacked and really, in a very unscrupulous way, with great dishonesty, with lies. With people were trying to destroy him with lies. And he was puzzled by that. It was the only way you could say it. It would be one thing to be sort of destroyed by truth, but to be destroyed by lies. And he prayed to Babaji. He said, why are you letting such dishonorable people have power over me, in essence? You know, I'm an honorable man. I've devoted my life to you. Why are you letting these dishonorable people have power over me? And the answer he got from Babaji was this: they are all my children. which is a very extraordinary idea, because the human ego wants it all to work out neatly according to our particular narrow ideas of fairness and, you know, karmic due, and I've given you so many kriyas, you owe me so many blessings, you know, kind of energy. But Babaji said, this is all my lila. You know, the dark, the shadow, and the light, it all has to play itself out. Swamiji writes now, he says, I'm grateful for everything that happened because it liberates me. It liberated me, just freed me. And whatever came to me, of course, was my own karma. How could it not be? And when you really can just see it like that, that's how God beholds it. I mean, that's an amazing thing. Let my eyes behold as he beholds. I mean, I'm talking about the way the brain filters what it sees. But just imagine when you look out at the world sometimes that you're looking, that Yogananda's looking through your eyes. Swamiji made that comment on his anniversary message. He said, so often he feels now as if Master were looking at the world through his eyes. That's really quite a statement. And you come to that by the constant conscientious effort to discipline your own inclinations so that that is how you perceive. You know, that's what we do when we try to help each other. We just try to look at one another and think, you know, how would Divine Mother respond to this? And sometimes she's stern. I want you to understand that. But if you're stern as God is stern, that's quite different than if you're being stern as the ego would be stern. But also, everything is beautiful to the divine eye, even that which is ugly. Again, as Swami put it so sweetly, even when he sees people suffering, he thinks only how much greater will be their joy when they're finally liberated. Isn't that an amazing thing? If you can just move away from time, look at your own self in the mirror and realize what a mess you're in right now, but how much sweeter it'll be when you're finally out of it. Because that's how Divine Mother looks at you. She never sees you as anything but a being of light. That's what Master said, remember? If you could only see yourselves as I see you, you would realize that you're nothing but light, beautiful light. So let our eyes behold as he beholds. Then let my ears listen to his truths alone. Again, that means not to let Maya persuade us that something else is true. Either self-doubt, self-aggrandizement, anxiety about our own welfare, the feeling that we're not understood or not being treated fairly. I mean, how many ways are there that we move ourselves off of center? And so let my ears listen to his truths alone. That means to hear truth in whatever's being said to you, meaning to look behind and see a divine power, even when people are speaking lies to you. And when Swami was speaking about there, why are all these people telling these untruths and having the right over me? Well, Babaji just said, oh, they're just speaking on, you know, they're my children. They're just speaking too. There's a truth behind it. And the truth is, God is always acting for our own best interest, whatever we might think. Let my intellectuality become his wisdom. No, let my mind become his mind. Let my intellectuality become his wisdom. You know, all of these aspects of ourselves are not to be denied, but merely to be elevated. You know, saintly people are quite intelligent as a rule. They may not be intellectual, but they're intelligent in the way that intelligence matters, which is that they're able to see deeper realities. They're be able to respond appropriately to complex situations. They're able to perceive truth where it might even be obscured. But intellectuality is not the same as wisdom, because wisdom is that which draws everything back to God. Intellectuality merely can just explain everything. I remember once, even in a very specific sense, we had a difficulty in one of our departments at Ananda. It was just a big area and it just wasn't running well. Somebody wrote to Swamiji what I thought was an extremely good letter. I was a secretary at the time, explaining what the problem was, and, you know, just really, it was a very good analysis. I thought it was a really good letter. And I'm sure Swami was trying to teach me too. Swami read it and then he crumpled it up and he threw it on the floor. And he said, anybody can tell me what the problem is. He said, what I want is someone who will say, I'll take responsibility and fix it. And, you know, that was a really big shift in my awareness of the difference between, you know, of course we have these difficulties, but what we have to do is we have to find the wisdom to be able to bring things back to harmony. I've had that those experiences. I've joked with some of you once when we were facing a difficulty in the community and someone was very displeased with someone else's behavior, and they sort of just came to me with this, so-and-so was doing this, and they shouldn't be doing that, and they shouldn't be doing this, and they should be doing that. And my response was, why don't we take him out into the green and shoot him? You know? Because if we just executed him, then we just wouldn't have to deal with his nature anymore, would we? You know? And but it was sort of like, and of course, I wasn't serious, but it really, the person I was talking to just didn't know what to say. I said, because otherwise what you're telling me is that this person has limitations, is expressing their limitations, you know, they're sincere on their spiritual path, and they're not self-realized. So given that, you know, it just doesn't do any good to just make a big list of their problems. We have to do something about it. And so if we don't execute them, we're going to have to deal with them. So what do you suggest, you know? But that's a lot of times what we're asking for. We're just asking for things to go away because they bother us too much. And that's not wisdom. Intellectuality will sort of reason that out. But wisdom says, you know, people are part of this family and we just have to work with them. And there's no way around it. Wisdom is very different. Let my love seek nothing but his love. That's I like that extra little part. Because it says, let my love become his love. And then it says, let my love seek nothing. There's a little extra point in there. Because isn't that what love does? Love goes out seeking some other object. It seeks fame. It seeks pleasure. It seeks romance. It seeks all sorts of other things. And what we're asked, actually, it's actually a prayer. You know, let my love not be seeking out in all these different ways to comfort itself. This is, I've been sharing with you at another time, the part of the Nayaswami vow that some of us have taken says, within myself, all the opposites of duality resolve. I'm not saying that exactly accurate. I looked at it yesterday and it wasn't exactly those words. But it just to have the karmic opposites just come to peace within you is the exact opposite of having your love seeking all the time, seeking some object instead of realizing that everything that we really seek is already divine within us. Is this challenging? Oh my, yes. But is it worth doing? See, what it is in order to live properly, even a renunciate vow like this, it's not like we fold up our tents or just sort of withdraw into our rooms and shut the door and never come out or become really dull and sort of lifeless. I mean, that's self-evident. You know, you look at Swami Kriyananda, he defines it, and you go from there. You look at Master's life, and he defines it, and you go from there, and then you look around at all the devotees. But there's something that's going on inside of us. And so even if we find ourselves, you know, married, having children, with many friends and, you know, many relationships, still, if our love is always seeking something other than his love, for one thing, it makes us always just a little bit egoically self-concerned. You know, that's where egoic self-concerns comes from. I don't have something and I want it. I don't have something I need and I have to have it. So we're always making ourselves restless. If we're content, then we are able to hear, to see the world as God sees it because we don't have any stake in it. And you have to also understand that the way God sees the world is from a continuous flow of unconditional love. And in the next section of these lessons, it refers to the chapter in the autobiography of a yogi, the cauliflower robbery story, but it also refers to the part where Master was going to lead the ashramites on a parade around the city, and it was so extremely hot, and they were walking barefoot, and it was going to be very hard on their bare feet to walk on the hot streets and on the hot sands of the beach. And, you know, they were going to do it, but it was an anxiety. I mean, we just had a mildly hot day today, and you can only imagine. And so Master was speaking to Sri Yukteswar with some concern about that, and Sri Yukteswar said, don't worry. And then just as they started to go out, a small group of clouds, a thin layer of clouds came over, blocked the sun, and sent cooling rain down on them. And it lasted just as long as their parade. And when their parade was done, it went away and it was sunny again. And Swamiji tells us to think of that story, because there's also that side of God's view of us, which is this sweet and loving concern that doesn't always rescue us from difficulties. But if it doesn't actually rescue us, if our consciousness is right, it gives us an inner comfort that neutralizes whatever the external difficulty is. I've been working, as you all know, on gathering stories now for this book of answered prayers and miracles, and it's really quite amazing the things that God does with people. Some of them are so, on one level, unimportant, except, you know, if you have a love relationship with someone, isn't it often just the little tiny things that really matter? Oh, look, you know, you bought me the ripe figs. Oh, you remembered how much I liked that, you know, that drink from that store that you were at today. I mean, it's often just the littlest things that come into your life from the person that you love that touch you much more than all the great big things, because it's like, it's not necessary. And it's just an expression of affection. So, let my love seek nothing but his love. He is my beloved, who will always love me. We just make that very simple, straight statement. Isn't that what everyone longs for? We all want a beloved who will always love us. Oh, promise me that you will always love me. How many songs are written about that? Or on the other side, I promise I will always love you. I remember when it first began to occur to me that all popular songs were about men, you know, about people loving each other. I mean, I just sort of remember just waking up one day and realizing that's all they're ever talking about. I just wasn't conscious of it for quite some time. I thought, isn't there any other subject? But it just was just growing, you know, how important this is, because that longing to love and be loved is the way we're made. So Master is really responding to the way we're made. He is my only beloved who will always love me. That's why in the Catholic monasteries, the women especially, the nuns go through such an enormous ritual of becoming the bride of Christ and taking Christ as a husband and often wearing a wedding band or even a wedding dress. And people from the outside, you know, especially these days, it's common to be cynical about things like that, but there's nothing cynical about it. It's an extremely active, real, it's not imagination, it's a genuine relationship and an extremely appropriate thing to do. If things become institutionalized, they may lose some of their inner reality, but all great devotees of God have a romance. And they have a romance in the terms that people have human romances, and people who don't understand it really don't understand it. But for the devotee, it's like these are what these words are about. You know, using them in these transitory ways defiles the words. The only beloved is the divine. He is my only beloved who will always love me. I love that Master throws that in, who will always love me. You can sort of say that to yourself. He will always love me. Let my aspiration be to carry out his will gladly. I love the way he adds that phrase, gladly. A sad saint is a sad saint indeed. You know, and to carry out his will is really talking about understanding his will is not separate from ours, but it's separate sometimes from our misunderstanding of what is right for us. So to do what God wants us to do and to do it happily indicates both faith and hopefully some comprehension. And it's not enough merely to carry it out morbidly, but we have to carry it out also with joy, or else we're not carrying it out. And often it's better to be sincere. Swamiji said, I prefer an honest argument than a mindless yes, because at least then we're working with our realities here. Okay, why don't we take a short break, and then we'll come back and finish this. Okay? We've been having a discussion during the break about music and environment and how harsh music affects you and so on. What I wanted to say was, after reading the book about the yugas, and this is one of the, among many reasons why I recommend it, I've actually relaxed a great deal about a lot of anxieties that I've had about the society around me. I've become almost manic in my aversion to some of the music that's played in public places, and I've just become comical in my little one-person campaign to get them to stop. You know, it's just like I've become a joke. Here comes that old woman who hates our music kind of energy again. And I still feel that way, but I just relaxed a lot because this is just the yuga that we're in. This is the common denominator consciousness, and what do I expect? It's just not possible for society as a whole to express above this level because it just isn't. It's just going to be like this, and it's just not going to be better on this planet until the yuga changes. And we can continue to do our little bit off to the side because it is an ascending yuga, and therefore it's worthwhile. Somebody was saying, what difference does it make to the individual souls? Well, it makes a huge difference because it's an ascending yuga, we're living in Palo Alto trying to build this whole work. If it were a descending yuga, we'd be living out in the middle of the desert and we have just turned our back on society. Why bother? The barbarians are about to sweep in and just destroy it anyway. That's what they did after Jesus lived. They all just went out and lived as far away from people as they could get. And then they gradually hoarded and saved remnants of civilization so that when the barbarians swept through, literally destroyed everything, which is what happens in the descending Kali Yuga. But otherwise, it just can't hit a note higher than it's capable of hitting, except in isolated created pockets like us. We're just completely out of tune with the age, which is the really, really good news. You know, wouldn't it be, part of me thinks, what would it mean if we ever got popular? It would just be terrifying. I mean, on the level of the fact that how could we possibly be in tune with this society? It's just not our world. And, you know, we keep drawing people because it is an ascending yuga and individual soul evolution is independent of the yuga. But watching like a three-year-old and you sort of think, what is his real destiny? Is he destined to participate in this? Is he destined to transcend it? You know, and you give him as many influences as you can so that at least he'll have an awareness of choice. But it's very tough on young people right now. You know, people coming up in their 20s and 30s to really figure out where they fit, what to do. Yeah. All right. Anything else? Comments or thoughts? Okay. Then we come to this very well known, I will reason, I will, I will act, but guide thou my reason, will, and activity to the right path in every action. That line has been pulled out and quoted so many times. But it completely epitomizes when people ask you what's the essence of the spiritual path, that's about it. Because it's self-will, but divine guided. So you have it's initiative, you have to do it yourself, but you want to do it in harmony with God. That's the whole idea of self-realization, is that you're still there, but you're not acting on your ego, you're acting from God's inspiration. And then more about love. How many times does he mention love? Be yours, the only love reigning in the bower of my heart. To please you, I will act, but not for my own desires. So again, Master's asking us to be dynamic in our relationship. To please you, I will act, but not for my own desires. In carrying out your wishes, I will be ambitious. And we also have to understand, even in this context, that we can't become too self-preoccupied in trying to discern what God wants me to do. Somebody once asked Swamiji, how do I know what my dharma is? Swami said, well, if there's a job to do and you're the next one in line. I mean, it was like he didn't want to give it any more energy than that. There's often nowadays in these strange sort of slightly off-center teachings that people have, there's this tremendous emphasis on doing God's will and each individual having, you know, a destiny and so on. But instead of it becoming ego-dissolving, that very thought causes people to become more egocentric. What does God want me to do? And you're using God's name, but you're just constantly asking, what does he want me to do? What am I supposed to do? What is my destiny? What is my place in life? And we have to also understand that, I've tried to express this at other times, it's a little tricky to get, but once you're a disciple, you have kind of a broad-based assignment. And that broad-based assignment is to do what was important for the guru. I mean, this is what, when I first moved to Ananda Village, I prided myself on being completely uninterested in building the community, because my interest was in learning from Swami Kriyananda, and I considered everything else that was going on uninteresting and a slight intrusion. And one day it occurred to me that Swami Kriyananda was not indifferent to the building of the community. In fact, he was working extremely hard to build the community all the time. And so first it occurred to me that maybe he was on to something that I should pay attention to. And then I just put it in even in a different way. Just as his friend, if this project was so important to him, it would behoove me as his friend to help him. But I also began to realize on a much broader sense, he had a commission from Master. This is Master came and Master declared, you know, many things that he wanted to have happen in this world. And who is going to do it? Swami has recently written and rewritten and written again the book that he first called Rescuing Yogananda, then Restoring the Legacy, and now he's calling it Yogananda for the World. It keeps shifting. But he keeps, the essence of that book is saying that those who have been in charge of self-realization for all these 60-some years since Yogananda passed away have done what they wanted to do. And they haven't listened very carefully to what he really wanted to do. They've allowed their own preferences to cloud their judgment in what his intentions were. And Swami just enumerates what his intentions were, and, you know, how he saw this teaching and how he wanted communities. And we don't really have to ask very hard what our divine task is, because our divine task is to be disciples, and the disciple's task is to serve the guru. Well, we can't really bring him his slippers or make him his dinner. You know, it's just not an option to us. And what really matters to the guru? Well, the guru comes to create this divine work, to help the whole world to have a new understanding. So it's his will for us, his wish for us, is to pick up some piece of that and carry it. You know, whatever suits us, and it almost doesn't matter. I remember just trying to get this point across in the early years of Ananda. It was especially difficult for men who have a stronger idea of personal career. Some women do, but men have it more strongly, especially when we had young men who had never had a chance to prove themselves in the world. But just trying to and Swamiji would always try to help us understand, you have a very noble career. You have a great and wonderful career, and that career is to build Ananda. And you're building Ananda because it's what Master wanted to have happen. And Swamiji always talks about Henry the First as William's son, and now Henry was so unusual as a king because he had no ambition of his own. His only ambition was to restore what his father had set up and then to stabilize it and to make it enduring. But once he had accomplished that, once he had reconquered territory if it was needed, reset boundaries if it were needed, reestablished policies if it were needed, he never went further than that, which was just unheard of, because all the kings of that time were just always trying to get bigger and bigger. He was only trying to carry out what William had wanted to have done. William had set the mission in motion, and Swami solidified it and gave it form. And that's exactly what's happening now. And for that, in carrying out your wishes, I will be ambitious. And look how ambitious Master was. Look how hard he worked. Look how ambitious Swamiji is. But only for God's will, not for myself. It's a very important point to understand. And then it says, to receive you, I renounce all else. Well, as many as received him, to them gave he the power. Receiving is to be on the right wavelength. So to be on the right wavelength, to be able to merge our consciousness with God, means we have to give up all those other selfish, self-interested ideas. This is a lifetime of practice. Don't be dismayed here. I will never marry. This is a monk's vow, for you are my only beloved. My flesh, my mind, my love, My life, my soul, belong to you, O Spirit, and no animality shall desecrate what belongs to you. I've always admired that. I thought it was such a delicate and far-reaching way to say so many different things. Because, now this was a vow for monks, and so celibacy was implied by that. But even if you're not a monk, the concept of animality, you know, in other words, even living in our body, we can live in a more or less elevated way. You know, we don't have to feel ourselves merely to be physical, which is what the concept of an animal is. An animal doesn't have a higher sense of awareness. So we need to live in our bodies with a higher sense of awareness and not see our bodies as just merely something to express and enjoy. Then once again, you are my lover, I am your beloved. And then, father and mother, I am your child, you are my master, I am your servant, you are my friend, I am your friend, you are my guru, I am your disciple. These are all the relationships that a human being can have. You know, we have the romantic, we have the master, we have the equality of friends, we have the student and his teacher. So we're just, and the mother and the father and the child, we just bring it all in. In other words, everything that we long for is fulfilled in the divine. My hands will work for you only, my feet will march unceasingly towards your kingdom. Now, Master's just being so beautifully poetic in all of this. This is again where I was saying at the beginning, he gives us his vibration and he asks us to feel it. You know, my hands will work for you only. And these are also saying that everything I do, I will do for you. It's not just that I will only work for the sake of the divine, of this project or something like that, but everything that I do, I will consider it to be something that I'm doing for you. And therefore we have to ask ourselves, you know, is this serviceful? Is this loving? Is this kind what I'm doing? Am I doing it with divine consciousness? Am I generous? You know, what am I using my hands for? Because everything about us belongs to God. And I love, my feet will march unceasingly towards your kingdom. You know, just harnessing all of our energy for the divine. My brain will work your problems alone. My heart will love you alone. My heart, my mind, my soul will become your spirit. So we do heart, mind, and soul again. And then, finding your perfect love, again, I shall seek no other love. And now he's declaring it as this is what's going to happen. Finding it, I won't seek elsewhere. Every restlessness can be solved by going to God. Finding you, I have found everything, and so I have renounced nothing. I will not work to please myself or anyone else except my guru and God. That's also interesting. He just throws in that or anyone else. You know, no one who tries to come between us and the divine. We have to have the courage to turn away from them. I answered this letter this woman wrote where she said, my parents are forcing me to marry someone that I don't think, that I don't love in the way I wanted to love the person I married. I wrote back and said, you know, if you're old enough to marry, you're probably old enough to walk in and out of a room on your own. And old enough to get a job, get a passport, you know, to do anything that you might need to do. What you're really saying is that it's very inconvenient to refuse them because it's going to create disharmony and might impoverish you, who knows. But don't mistake those two things. You know, you're not being forced. You're being asked. You're being challenged. And I went on to speak of it for many other levels. But, you know, we always have to realize that nobody can force us to do anything. We might have very, very difficult decisions to make. We might lose life, liberty, health, well-being, all kinds of things. But I will not work to please myself. I'm not going to do it for my ego, and I'm not going to do it for anybody else's egos either. I will only do it for God and Guru. Everything. Work means action. So it's always important to make sure that everything that we're doing is in harmony with what God and Guru would want and not to allow lesser considerations to step in. It's a big challenge. You know, in our personal relationships, how would I put it? This woman... I think you've heard this story before. It's in my book, actually. She wanted to attract a husband, and she heard that if you make a very specific list of the qualities that you want in a husband, you're more likely to attract it. So she made a 2 or 3 page list of all the qualities that she wanted in a husband. And for some reason or another, she showed it to Swami Kriyananda, maybe hoping that he would find one for her who would match that criteria. And he read through, you know, and each qualification was more and more grand. And finally, Swami looked at her and he said, "My dear, you're asking for Jesus Christ for a husband." And then he looked at her like, "I hate to be the one to break the news to you, and I have to tell you, Jesus would not marry you." And he said, "And even if he would, you wouldn't be happy with him." He said, "You really need someone a little more on your level." So she rewrote her request and asked that she get a husband who loved God and who had a good sense of humor. And very shortly after, she met that husband and has been married happily to him for many years. But you can make close alliances with people as long as they love God, as long as they understand that you can't please anyone except God and Guru. But if you're united in your understanding that that's your first priority, then you can love someone very much. You can live very close with them. And if you find yourself allied to someone or working for someone or in the family of someone, you just have to quietly refuse. Hari Das once, when he was in charge of the Sacramento Center, and they never had any money and they always were struggling, and he went out for a while and had to get a job, and he was working for some demolition company. And I don't know all the details of it, but the boss wanted to cut a few corners in some way. And Hari Das sort of saw it coming. And for several days, he knew that the boss was going to ask him to do something that wasn't quite honest. And he kept praying to Master because he liked the job and he liked the boss, and he knew he couldn't do it. And he just sort of prayed and prayed and prayed. And when the boss finally came, as if I have the story correctly, and I may have it wrong, I think the boss finally did just sort of make a proposal to him that wasn't quite honest. And Hari Das just said, "Oh, you know I can't do that." And the guy said, "Okay." You know, just after all that. But Hari felt it was exactly because he had just said to Master, "You know, I really need this job. I don't know how we'll pay the rent, but I can't do it. So you have to protect me." So he didn't protect him from it coming, but he just was able to say it, and then it just dissipated like that. You'll find that where there's Dharma, there's victory. And you can be honest with people. Just, I love the way he did that. "Oh, you know I can't do that." Like that. I remember once I was with Paula, and a friend of ours was dying of cancer, and her father had come and was living in her house because he was so upset because she was dying. We called up and wanted to go visit our friend Shraddha, as it were. Her father's name was, Shraddha's father was Jake, and Jake and Shraddha had a very tempestuous relationship. And Paula called and talked to Jake and said, "We want to come over and visit." Jake said, "She's too tired, she can't have visitors." Bang, just put the phone down. So three women were together and were saying, when Shraddha was strong enough to make her own decision, she really did not like to have Jake run her life. We all know that. So just because she's weak now and he's able to answer the phone, I bet she doesn't really want him to run her life either. And so we decided that we would go over to see her anyway. And fortunately, I had the sense to let Paula take the lead on it because I would have handled it less well and it wouldn't have come out as nicely. We got there and Jake saw us. He opens the door. He said, "I told you not to come." Paula just said, just as simple as could be, "Oh, Jake, we just had to come." And Jake said, "She's tired, she shouldn't see anybody." Paula said, "Oh, Jake, we just had to come." And they went through it 3 times. And then Jake said, "Well, don't stay too long." Just like that, and just stepped to the side. But it was sort of like, I mean, I think of it in this. It was like she knew, Paula knew, that Shraddha needed to see us and that it was the right thing. But she didn't actually oppose Jake. She just affirmed what had to happen. And he stood there in opposition to it, but she never related to him as opposition. She just kept saying what had to happen. And he didn't have anything to fight against. If I had done it, because I was not as adept as Paula was, because she's passed away too, at looking at things the way God looks at them, and I would not have seen Jake as one of Babaji's own, I would have given Jake something to oppose, and then we would have had a really big fight on our hands. We probably never would have gotten in that door. It was an incredible lesson for me. So I will not work to please myself or anyone else, but I will do it only for God and Guru. That work means all action. Finding perfect love in meditation, I shall never seek perishable human love. Master revisits that over and over again. It's the greatest illusion of all. Swamiji says to us now, once you're over it, you can't imagine how it ever held you. He just shakes his head like this. Master promised him he would conquer it completely, and he has, and he just shakes his head. He said, looking at a whole table full of married couples, he said, I know how you all feel, but he said, once you're out of it, you can't imagine. You just can't imagine why you felt you needed something other than God's love. But we do, so we do it. Finding God's complete love, I shall seek no other love. All things which are mine belong to thee. That's just so sweet, isn't it? All things which are mine belong to thee. Bear in mind, he doesn't say all material things. You know, that means our faults, our failings, our mistakes, our weaknesses, our fears, everything that we think of as our own really are not ours at all. They all belong to you. We tend to think of, when we say something like that, we get to give him all the good stuff, but we have to keep all the bad stuff. But it's almost more like we feel obligated to keep the bad stuff. That's not so. Swamiji said to us so many years ago, God is pleased when you give him your successes, but he's more pleased when you bring him your failures. That's an extraordinary thing to meditate on, because if we bring him our failures, we're really accepting that I come from you and everything belongs to you. And, you know, so it didn't go well. Well, there you have it, Lord. This is what happens when you leave me on my own. You know, you didn't guide my reason and will enough. You left me to figure it out, and I made a mess of it. What did you expect? You know, all things which are mine belong to you. Therefore, I give myself and all I possess to you alone. Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it just beautiful? Well, nothing more can be said about that. There's so many, we have so many different ways that we can draw closer to God, but this is certainly one of them. So any thoughts or comments on that before we consider tonight? I'm so glad to be reintroduced to that. We used to focus on that a lot in the first 10 years of my spiritual life.
Huh. It's one reason why it's so great to hang out with devotees, because those who do aspire to give everything to God,
yeah,
and you know you're relating to a person like that than someone in true opposition,
yeah,
it's really great to hang out with devotees.
Yeah, environment really helps. Well, that's purity of environment too, Alan, is the company you keep. It's not merely your physical environment, but it's the company you keep. Yeah. That's why Master wanted communities. He really didn't think devotees could do it alone in this yuga. It's too hard. The yuga is too, I mean, just talking about it, the yuga is so out of tune with what we're doing. I mean, I love it. We come in and we our little group sings, there's joy in the heavens, a smile on the mountain. And, you know, and that's not an introduction to the big drum roll and the big smashing sort of thing. It's just from some other astral universe. And those who are in tune with it just light up, and those who aren't don't even see it. They just can't even see it. It just goes right past them. All right. Okay, great souls. That was fun. If any of you, you know, you all got my email, I presume, that I'm really serious about gathering stories for this book of Miracles and Answered Prayers. So email me if you have stories. You can either write them or we'll talk on the phone. I've sort of concentrated. I'm going up to Ananda Village this weekend, so I'm focusing more on getting stories from there. But when I come back here, I'll be knocking on your doors.